Following are comments on Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus, Act 1. I'll find a day to massacre them all. Titus enters Rome in triumph, and his sons sacrifice Alarbus, conquered Goth Queen Tamora's eldest son. Titus turns down the position of emperor and instead chooses Saturninus. The latter chooses Lavinia, Titus's daughter, as his empress. But when her betrothed, Bassianus, escapes with her, helped by Titus's sons, one of whom the old general kills, Saturninus marries Tamora. The new empress counsels Saturninus and swears revenge against Titus. Titus invites the new emperor and empress on a celebratory hunt. As we enter Act 1, Scene 1, a good starting point for thinking about Titus Andronicus is T.J.B. Spencer's often-cited observation that the play is, quote-unquote, a summary of Roman politics. He continues, quote-unquote, it is not so much that any particular set of political institutions is assumed in Titus, but rather that it includes all the political institutions that Rome ever had. The author seems anxious not to get it all right, but to get it all in. Titus is not a historical play in the usual sense, but it nonetheless offers an insightfully layered and complex picture of Rome that may do the great city more justice than some factual histories. According to the Norton Shakespeare's editor, Titus Andronicus is set in the 4th century of the Common Era, and it depicts a Roman world in which Tamora, a Goth queen only recently brought to Rome in chains, is elevated to supreme power alongside the new emperor. A valiant old guard Roman general, Titus Andronicus is first crushed by his rigid belief in an ancient code of honor that almost nobody else respects, and then spurred to a revenge worthy of the play's so-called barbarians themselves, Titus Andronicus may well be the last Roman. He may also be the Roman who shows us how complicated and cosmopolitan that famous appellation really is. In her introduction to Titus Andronicus, Norton editor Catherine Eisenman Mouse observes shrewdly that the temporal setting Shakespeare chose underscores the impermanence and instability of Rome. Early modern audiences would have known that the great empire's collapse followed shortly thereafter. See the Norton introduction, page 138. In Act 1, Scene 1, Titus, a soldier of 40 years standing, returns to Rome with his trophy Goths, Tamora, and her sons, only to be confronted with the bickering of Saturninus and Bassianus over the imperial succession. While Saturninus proclaims his right as the firstborn son of the late emperor, Bassianus advances his cause in the name of virtue, quote-unquote, suffer not dishonor to approach the imperial seat, he pleads to the tribunes, senators, and his own followers. Act 1, Scene 1, lines 13 through 14. Bassianus's claim seems to us the better one, but it cuts against the basic assumptions of an imperial system of inherited rule. Titus is a traditionalist, so he feels obligated to choose the dead emperor's firstborn. And unfortunately, that's the selfish, immature, fail son, Saturninus. Between them, Bassianus and Saturninus play out the dilemma of monarchical rule, which is that it often pits virtue and talent against mere entitlement and dishonest scheming. Titus has just returned from 10 years of fighting in Rome's cause, and all ears await his sentence as to who should take the throne. The heroic general's speech to the assembled Romans is magnificent in its honest reckoning of the losses he has willingly borne for his country, and moving in its attention to the children he has lost. Quote unquote, Titus, unkind and careless of thine own, why sufferest thou thy sons unburied yet to hover on the dreadful shore of Styx? Act 1, Scene 1, lines 89 through 91. Titus is a Roman of the old school, a believer in pietas, piety, to family and state. It's interesting to note that the exact composition of the gathering to whom Titus speaks is not entirely clear. The language just quoted sounds almost like material for a soliloquy. It's a remarkably intimate thing for him to say if others are listening. By request of his remaining sons, therefore, Titus will sacrifice conquered Tamora's eldest son. Titus's sons explain clearly why they want to commit this act. Quote unquote, "So the shadows be not unappeased, nor we disturbed with prodigies on earth." Act 1, Scene 1, lines 103 through 104. Titus agrees to this demand without hesitation, but Tamora is quick to see the affair as hypocrisy. She asks, quote unquote, "Must my sons be slaughtered in the streets for valiant doings in their country's cause?" Act 1, Scene 1, lines 115 through 116. Her sons have only done what Titus's would do in defense of their homeland. Tamora's plea, quote unquote, "Thrice noble Titus, spare my firstborn son," is revealing in that its numerical quality suggests a world in which everything can be quantified or accounted for. Act 1, Scene 1, line 123. Surely this strange honor code that Titus believes in is expansive enough to allow for generosity towards the eldest son of a valiant defeated queen. Titus is thrice noble, so he ought to be magnanimous in victory. But Titus disagrees. The honor code is strict, and the demand of blood for blood cannot be refused without shame. It would, in fact, constitute an outrage against the memory of Titus's dead sons. So, Tamora's individual, deeply personal heartache, her natural appeal as a mother, must be subordinated to Roman ritual. Piety must be upheld, and the general tells her to, quote-unquote, patient, or calm herself, while this supposed act of Roman religiosity is accomplished. Act 1, Scene 1, line 124. Tamora's denunciation seems appropriate, and she spits, quote-unquote, "Oh, cruel, irreligious piety." Act 1, Scene 1, line 133. She may be a barbarian queen, but she is no fool. Barbarism, so-called, is a worthy concept in Shakespeare's play. The powerful Goths, while not being in anything like a state of savagery, nonetheless serve as a ground for the anxieties of the Romans, a storied, civilized people, about their relationship to violence, their sense of identity, and the efficacy of their own language. Tamora and her sons both do and do not understand Rome. The question is, how well does Rome understand them and itself? The aftermath of the deed done by Titus's sons is announced with the words, quote unquote, "Alarbus's limbs are lopped, and entrails feed the sacrificing fire, whose smoke like incense doth perfume the sky." Act 1, Scene 1, lines 146 through 148. The alliteration of the first line is deliciously absurd and lets us in on the comic dimension of this otherwise tragic play. Titus Andronicus has an over-the-top feel, a tendency to revel in its scenes of violence and criminality that mark it as a fine example, and more to the point, even a parody of Elizabethan revenge tragedies that were already based on the gobsmackingly violent revenge plays of the Roman author Seneca. Shakespeare was young when he wrote Titus, as a professor of mine used to suggest by way of accounting for the play's exuberance. Well, that's true, but it's a masterpiece of its kind, a barbaric masterpiece, perhaps. And it was composed around the time the playwright wrote The Taming of the Shrew and Richard III. The Elizabethans loved this kind of limb-hacking, blood-spattered spectacle, as the popularity of the other plays, such as Thomas Kidd's The Spanish Tragedy and Christopher Marlowe's The Jew of Malta, attest. Dexter Morgan and Hannibal Lecter make room for any number of Elizabethan revenge characters. With Alarbus's limbs duly lopped and the great god Alliteration appeased, Titus must return to public responsibility. Offered the throne in his own right, he magnanimously turns it down with the utterance, quote unquote, "Give me a staff of honor for mine age, but not a scepter to control the world." Act 1, Scene 1, lines 201 through 202. As kingmaker, he chooses Saturninus, the deceased emperor's eldest son, who promises to wed Lavinia out of gratitude for this service. Act 1, Scene 1, lines 241 through 243. Bassianus, however, is by no means at peace with this arrangement. With the aid of Titus's sons, he escapes with his beloved Lavinia, Titus's daughter, to whom he is already betrothed. Titus's descent into misery begins immediately after his ill-fated, yet Rome-ratified, choice of emperors. His son Mutius bars his way in pursuit of the absconders, and, shockingly, Titus kills him on the spot. No hesitation, no reflection necessary. Act 1, Scene 1, lines 293 through 295. All the same, the ungrateful new emperor, Saturninus, takes the event badly. He at once replaces Lavinia with the woman of his fancy, the captured Tamora, lovely queen of Goths. The perverse nature of this choice is implied in Tamora's promise to the young man, quote unquote, "If Saturnine advance the queen of Goths, she will a handmaid be to his desires, a loving nurse, a mother to his youth." Act 1, Scene 1, lines 333 through 335. Titus has given control of Rome to an immature, narcissistic young man who seeks a mother in the barbarian woman who, for understandable reasons, wants to destroy it. Perhaps, though, this elevation of a ruthless Goth to rule beside the Roman emperor is Rome's confession as to what kind of place it really is, and always has been. As empress, Tamora deviously smooths things over for Titus, who has been left to lament the betrayal by his sons of the reputation he held dear. Act 1, Scene 1, lines 430 through 440, inclusive. As she explains to the inexperienced young emperor, she does this, the better to crush Titus and his entire line when Saturninus is secure on the throne. Quote unquote, "I'll find a day to massacre them all and raise their faction and their family." Act 1, Scene 1, lines 452 through 453. And so, the act ends with Tamora's chilling pronouncement, Saturninus's offer of a double wedding, and Titus's promise of fine hunting to bring them all together in pleasurable pursuits. Once again, it may be worth noting that speech such as the lines by Tamora quoted just above have a soliloquy-like quality. The Queen of Goths is uttering her own originally private grievance in a way that colonizes the will of Saturninus and the Roman state. The personal has become the political in a most destructive manner. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Monday, January 12, 2026. The foregoing material is copyright 2026 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume genre-based format.